You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Christian Parenti, author of Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence. Christian Parenti is a contributing editor at The Nation, a Puffin Foundation Writing Fellow at The Nation Institute, and a visiting scholar at the City University of New York. He has a PhD in sociology from the London School of Economics. And in addition to Tropic of Chaos, his books include Lockdown America, The Soft Cage, and The Freedom. Christian Parenti has written for Fortune, The New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Washington Post, Playboy, Mother Jones, and the London Review of Books. He has held fellowships from the Open Society Institute, Rockefeller Brother Fund, and the Ford Foundation, and has won numerous awards, including the 2009 Lang Taylor Prize and Best Magazine Writing 2008 from the Society for Professional Journalists. He lives in Brooklyn, New York. When I spoke to Christian Parenti earlier this month, I asked him to begin by explaining the title of his new book, Tropic of Chaos.
Well, the Tropic of Chaos refers to the global south, the belt of post-colonial states that mostly lie between the Tropic of Cancer and Tropic of Capricorn, and so it's called that the Tropic of Chaos. And what makes the chaos is the violence and poverty and inequality and corruption and chaos that marks many of the societies in that terrain.
Right. That already marked those societies even before the addition of climate change.
Yes. I mean, the argument of the book is that climate change arrives on a stage in the global south preset for crisis. And the two pre-existing crises that climate change is now exacerbating are the crisis of militarism, primarily Cold War militarism, but now also the war on terror, and the legacy of radical free market economic policies or neoliberal structural adjustment as pushed by the World Bank and IMF, which is neoliberalism has been the prevailing orthodoxy for the last 20 to 30 years coming out of the financial institutions. And so that has created societies marked by inequality and poverty and other forms of dysfunction like broken infrastructure throughout much of the global south. And militarism has left many societies in the global south littered with cheap weaponry and men trained in the arts of smuggling and assassination and torture. And so into that context now comes drought, flooding, crop failure, all the natural calamities associated with climate change.
And you coin a term in the book, catastrophic convergence. Can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the catastrophic convergence is the combination of all of these three factors coming together. The legacy of the Cold War, the legacy of neoliberalism, and the onset of anthropogenic climate change and how they all interact together. So the argument is essentially that climate change doesn't operate on its own. It operates through the bad policies that we have already established.
Right. And why did you write the book?
I wrote the book to try and break the climate discussion out of its kind of discursive ghetto. It had been relegated to a specialty topic among environmentalists and scientists, largely because of the pushback of the oil and coal industry that invested large amounts of money in messaging since 2005, and even before that, pushing back against a rising concern around climate change. And so I just wanted to try and connect climate change to other discourses, this conversation about going on about development and about security, and also to wade into the security conversation around climate change, because there is such a conversation, from the left.
Right.
And not leave those concerns only to the right wing and to the military. Mm-hmm. Because when they acknowledge climate change, their response is not one that I would approve of. I mean, it is basically they acknowledge that there's an environmental crisis and then frequently call for more militarism, and that I think is only going to make the problem worse.
And you talk a lot about the effects of counterinsurgency in the book, and I guess actually now would be a good time to talk about that. Counterinsurgency is also has the abbreviation of COIN, and I'm wondering if you can talk about small wars.
Yeah, the military, to its credit, the American military takes the science of climate change seriously, and they have run projections, both secret and open, published on the web, about what climate change will do to the security environment. And they see an increase, not so much in interstate conflict, but of internal conflict, of civil war, religious war, ethnic violence, mass migration, state failure, humanitarian crisis. And they are aware that the armed services are going to be called upon to intervene in these crises over the coming decades. And so the style of response is counterinsurgency, low-intensity conflict, counterterrorism. That's what's front and center in their thinking in terms of climate change. Mm-hmm. And so I have a chapter in the book that looks at the history of counterinsurgency. And counterinsurgency is the theory of internal warfare and putting down rebellions. And so it's rooted in European colonial expansion, and the practices and tactics and strategies of counterinsurgency develop and emerge before the doctrine, but then the doctrine emerges slowly almost 100 years ago. There's a literature about how to fight small wars against restive natives and rebellious populations that emerges out of the British experience in Africa and elsewhere, and the American experience in the Caribbean and Central America. Mm-hmm. The Marines write a book called The Small Wars Manual. And, of course, the U.S. Marines, who intervened again and again in places like Nicaragua and Haiti and Dominican Republic, were using tactics that were developed rather ad hoc in fights against Native Americans and on the plains. But then this all begins to kind of coalesce into a doctrine.
Right.
And now that doctrine is something that is, the object of much discussion, and the military field manual on counterinsurgency is published and sold on Amazon, and COIN, as the acronym is quite in vogue, and General David Petraeus is a household name, and he's the kind of the hero of counterinsurgency, the tribune of COIN within the military, the general who turned the Iraq war around by means of counterinsurgency tactics. So what I try to do is put that discussion, which is usually happens in a pretty ahistorical fashion, put it in a historical context and also its climatological context, because the war on terror, quote unquote, is in many ways increasingly a response to climatologically driven breakdown. I mean, look at what's happening in Yemen. Look at what's happening in Libya. These are sites which the U.S. is now sending special forces and drones. Not Libya, there aren't drones, but there's aerial attack by the U.S. In Yemen, there's drone operations going on. But part of what triggered those conflicts is climate change. One of the triggering events for the Arab Spring, the Arab Awakening, which involves many positive democratic elements, but also has caused three wars, Libya, Yemen, and Syria, though one side in Syria seems to have very few guns. One of the triggers for that was the drought in 2010 that caused Russia to ban wheat exports, and the floods in the Midwest and Canada and floods in Australia, which caused corn prices to almost double. So wheat prices went up 83%, corn prices went up 91% from June 2010 to June 2011. And in the in North Africa, in Tunisia, in Egypt, where these protests and democracy movements jumped off, one of the first demands always was to lower the price of food. The last thing that President Ben Ali of Tunisia did before he left office was to promise to lower food prices. In Egypt, the average person spends 40% of their income on food, and last year the food inflation was running at 20% per year, because Egypt is also the largest single grain importer in the world. And so it was, you know, the trigger event in many ways was this Russian wheat ban, the surge in food prices, which was linked to extreme weather during the 2010 growing season. So, I mean, that's not explained when the military is now fighting chaos and Islamist guerrillas, you know, spreading across the Maghreb. But that's the reality.
Right, right.
And it's not to say that you know, these new small wars are reducible to climate change, but just that it is an important contributing factor in the situation.
In the book, you lay out the basics of your arguments, and then you lead readers through some examples of this Tropic of Chaos. And you're talking about crops reminds me of your section on Afghanistan. And this is a quote from the book: "In the face of drought and flooding, one crop brings relative security. Papaver somnif." I don't know if I said that. Somniferum, the opium poppy.
Yeah.
So I wonder if we can talk about that. Why is the opium poppy so important in Afghanistan?
Well, the opium poppy is important because it uses one-fifth the amount of water that wheat uses. And Afghanistan is suffering through the worst drought in living memory. And given that drought, opium poppy is the only crop that is economically feasible. And it therefore becomes part of what fuels the war, that this drought, if linked to climate change, I mean, it fits the larger pattern that climate scientists have predicted. But whether or not you can really blame any one drought on climate change is a different question. But given the drought, farmers have to grow opium poppies to survive because they simply can't grow wheat and make any money. The U.S. occupation and the NATO government attacks poppy. The Taliban defend poppy. So along with all the ethnic reasons and religious reasons a young man might have for joining the Taliban, there's this other economic incentive tied to the environmental crisis, which is that the Taliban is the side in the war that defends his family's right to grow the one crop that's economically feasible, given the drought, which is the worst in living memory that's gone on for about a decade.
And the Taliban used to be opposed to the growth of opium, right?
This is a point of confusion that many people have. No, the Taliban, for 1 year, the Taliban banned opium production, and in exchange for like $48 million in anti-drug money and development aid from the U.S. But the Taliban, for most of its time as a government, allowed people to grow opium, and as an insurgency, it has always supported opium. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was this, the 1 year before, like from 99 to 2000, they put a ban on opium, and there was such a backlog of opium that had already been produced that it actually didn't hurt farmers that much because prices had collapsed. So, yeah, that's a big confusion. Everyone thinks they have been anti-opium, but they have not really. There was just that 1 year ban, and it was actually, in many ways, a price support program.
Mm-hmm. These different regions that you talk about throughout the book, have you worked in most of them as a reporter, as a journalist?
Yes, I have worked in most of them.
I was wondering if you're in your work as a journalist, when you're first sent to a region, how do you start? Like who do you talk to?
Well, the first thing you need to do is you get a fixer, which is to say an interpreter. But a fixer is a journalist that one works with on the ground, local. So that's what foreign correspondents do. They rely on fixers. Even if you speak the language, generally you work with a fixer who can, you know, knows the roads, knows the people. And there's a network of correspondents who write internationally who know each other. And I mean, it's a network that's taken a battering with the collapse of journalism. There's not much money to do this kind of reporting, but so the first thing you want to do is you find a place to live, and you find a fixer, and then you proceed to get to know the place and pursue your stories.
And the existing network and perhaps people who were there and have left and you've replaced, that will all help you find your fixer and everything else.
Right. Yeah. You ask people you know. I mean, there's a website. Photographers are in many ways better networked than writers, and a lot of my friends have been photographers. People like Teru Koyama and Chris Anderson and Jessica Dimmock. And Teru actually even set up a website called Light Stalkers that was about this kind of shop talk stuff, people trading body armor and like numbers of fixers. And you know, if you're a member of Light Stalkers, you get in touch. You look at who's where, and you know, you reach out to people who live in wherever, Nairobi or Kabul, and shoot them an email. And more often than not, they have a place that they would suggest that you stay and can give you a few names for, somebody who might be, generally they have a fixer and they're like, oh, well, my fixer's cousin might work with you or whatever.
Yeah. How come photographers are better at that than journalists generally?
I think it is because they're much more into gear and technical stuff. Mm-hmm. And so there's a kind of... shop talk cooperation that doesn't happen with writers, and there's also there's more competition between writers for scoops. Oh. And that's less a part of photojournalism, getting a scoop. And so I think that is part of it. But I think to some extent it's just the gear draws them together. They're always talking about equipment, and they're constantly online like talking about gear, and so. I don't really understand the gear conversation, but I think that's the thing that that photographers really coalesce around in many ways. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it's just a little more social. Like photography as a trade within journalism is more social. Like when a photojournalist goes to meet an editor, they bring their portfolio and they usually meet in person and show, look at the photographs in real time and in hard form, and as a writer, you just send someone your clips, and it's all kind of distant and through the written word, and it's less about meeting people and looking at... I mean, photographs are objects, and that brings people together in space in real time, and you don't do that with writing. You wouldn't go by some editor's office and say, hey, here are five articles of mine. Why don't I read them to you? It's just not the way it's done. But,
right.
That's essentially what happens with a photographer. They're like, here's my portfolio. And so there's a kind of a more developed culture of networking among photojournalists.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, I want to talk about another one of the regions that you discuss in the Tropic of Chaos. This is a quote from the book, "The U.S.-Mexico border becomes a template for understanding dangerous global dynamics. All over the world, borders and policing regimes are hardening as restrictive immigration policies are matched by a xenophobic style of politics." It's a big subject, but I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about Mexico and its vulnerability to climate change.
Mexico is suffering a very serious drought, the worst drought in 60 years. Other parts of it have been flooded. Tabasco has been badly flooded twice in the last decade. And increasingly, people leaving the land in Mexico are driven not just by the disastrous free market economic policies that have been the hallmark of Mexican statecraft since the early 1980s, but also by the climatological crisis. And those migrants find themselves in northern Mexico, where, for other reasons, the society is in profound crisis due to the drug war. Also, northern Mexico, is just devastated by drought. And people are abandoning the ranches and abandoning the villages and moving into towns and getting into the drug trade, growing poppy, actually, growing marijuana, and making meth and moving cocaine up from Colombia. And so, and then the response of the Mexican government is just total, a completely ham-fisted militarized response by Calderon, who sent the military into the north, to the states along the U.S. border. But, for example, in the case of Juarez, didn't send any extra prosecutors or any support for the legal system. So instead, they're just soldiers driving around Juarez, waiting for bodies to show up, which they do every night. You know, and so it looks tough, but it's nothing but political theater. And then so now you have yet a new set of men with guns there to get involved in the drug trade. And the Mexican state, though there is an anti-corruption campaign underway right now as we speak, the Mexican state under Calderon has been totally entwined with the drug war.
Mm-hmm.
And it is riven with narcotic-tainted officialdom. So that's the larger crisis. And so you have this total breakdown of law and order. And when that happens, and there's a breakdown of the economy due to free trade, it's exacerbated by climate change. People flow into that zone where the economy has collapsed due to climate change. And the situation there is one of increasing lawlessness. Once the state becomes lawless and inept, then the whole social fabric breaks down. So now in Juarez, you have a situation that, if you know, it's not even right to call it a drug war, because that suggests more coherence than there really is. It's a state of total lawlessness, and people are being killed for all sorts of reasons.
You have a section in the book that talks about, you know, imagine being able to just kill someone and get away with it, and absolutely nothing will happen.
Yeah, I think I was quoting the excellent Chuck Bowden, whose book Murder City is all about Juarez. I mean, he's the main writer who's been covering Juarez since the 80s, and he's been predicting this for 20 years, and he lays this out. Yeah, any sociopath can pretty much get away with anything in Juarez, and if some guy suspects that somebody is sleeping with his wife, well, you can hire some drug-addled, unemployed teenager to go kill that person for $100, and chances are nothing will happen. In 2009, I have the numbers in the book, but two murders were prosecuted in Juarez.
Jeez.
You know, I mean, that basically means you have carte blanche to just do whatever you want.
And you say that these soldiers are driving around and waiting for the bodies to show up. So what happens when the body shows up? Really, literally nothing?
Yeah, then, the ambulance comes. They go through the process of pretending there's going to be a police investigation. They do the little notes, this, that, blah, blah, blah. They take the body away, file it away, feed it into the judicial system, essentially nothing. The public rituals of policing, they take away the body, they look for evidence, they pick up the shell casings, the detectives come and look around and take a few notes, but that's it.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about NAFTA? In the book, you describe how this would be the Colombian cartels, but that NAFTA made everything so much easier for them.
The Mexican Revolution created what was considered the first socialist constitution in the world. Article 27 of that constitution stipulated, down to the rock salt, that everything in the state of Mexico was the property of the government, and that private property existed only at the pleasure of the government. And post-revolutionary Mexico was marked by a lot of corruption and inequality and incompetence, but it also did have some progressive features. It had the ejido system, the collectively held rural lands were recognized and protected and could not be mortgaged off and lost. There was a heavy role for the state in guiding the economy. The economic theory was import substitution industrialization, and it didn't work perfectly, but it definitely worked to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole model begins to break down as the world economy goes into crisis in the 1970s, which is a complex story, but in a nutshell has to do with the fact that the world economy has finally recovered from the devastation of World War II, so markets are glutted and profit rates collapse, and therefore the ruling class in the U.S. and England in particular, and other northern European countries, but particularly in the Anglo-Saxon kind of capitalist core, decide that they have to abandon Keynesianism. They have to abandon this sort of economic theory that holds that there's a role for the state, for state ownership, for high taxation, for regulation within a capitalist economy. And they move from Maynard Keynes's ideas to those of Friedrich von Hayek and Milton Friedman, which holds that the government is nothing but a fetter on production and that government should be removed. So this transformation of economic thinking is happening in the late 70s, early 80s. At the same time, the world economy is slowing down. And a lot of the global South has borrowed heavily throughout the 60s and 70s, particularly during the 70s, borrowed heavily while money or credit was cheap. And it was cheap in part because of the oil boom. The oil crisis led to huge profits that were recycled by oil-producing countries through the Western banking system and were lent out at low but variable interest rates to developing economies in the global South. Mm-hmm. So there's all of this debt has been taken on in the 70s. The world economy is slowing down. There's a shift in economic planning in the elite capitalist core, and this then is then expressed as a new class war launched by Reagan and Thatcher. Part of that new class war involved jacking up interest rates to the highest points ever. The interest rates were up to 16, 17, 18% in the U.S. in the early 1980s. And the idea was to create what was called a cold bath recession, to plunge the U.S. economy into recession deliberately, and it was the worst recession since the Great Depression at that point, to help smash the working class in the developed economies in the core. And Thatcher was doing the same thing. The effect of that in the global South was to jack up the interest rates required on all of these loans that had been taken, at the same time that the markets for exports from the global South dried up due to the recession in the core economies. That created the debt crisis. In response to the debt crisis of the global South, and Mexico and Brazil in Latin America were the most indebted countries, the World Bank and the IMF and other international financial institutions offered survival loans to countries like Mexico and Brazil in exchange for radical free market restructuring. So that's when the Mexican state begins to undo everything, the legacy of the Mexican Revolution, and they specifically rewrite Article 27 of the Constitution, and they deregulate the economy. They allow in much more foreign ownership. They allow the privatization of collectively held land, and they embrace, in a word, neoliberalism. That leads to increased inequality, increased absolute poverty, and people start leaving the land, moving to cities, and the crisis that we now know as Mexico is born. And the effects of it have been, among other things, mass migration and a turn to the narcotics trade. At the same time, what's going on in the early 1980s is the cocaine flow out of Colombia shifts from the Caribbean through to Mexico, partly because Mexico, as part of its liberalization, is on a schedule of removing the state from the economy with a goal to sign the North American Free Trade Agreement. And the Colombian cocaine cartels see this as a great opportunity for moving cocaine into the U.S. using Mexico as a trampoline. Plus, the DEA is cracking down in Florida. So these two things cause a shift by the Colombian cocaine cartels towards Mexico. At first, the Mexican drug gangs are basically auxiliaries and sort of local assets for the Colombian cocaine cartels. But as they become more powerful, and they're increasingly paid in kind with drugs, there becomes a big drug market within Mexico, and these organizations become, they go into business for themselves, and so now you have these major Mexican drug cartels, such as the Gulf Cartel, the Sinaloa Cartel, the Zetas. The Zetas are actually a U.S.-trained special forces military, ex-military, Mexican military that were hired by the I believe it was the Gulf Cartel at first as sort of muscle, and then they have gone off on their own. They're actually importers and a whole force unto themselves, and they're major in Guatemala, and many of them were trained at the School of the Americas, because once upon a time in their younger days, many of the key Zetas were employees of the Mexican state. Special forces who then are fired for corruption or leave.
So they were U.S. trained as military and then went into the Zeta later.
Yeah, the Zetas starts out as a gang of ex-special forces soldiers that work for the Colombia, I think it's the Gulf cartel, as enforcers, as muscle, and then become an institution unto themselves that is in conflict even with their former employers, the Gulf cartel, and operate on their own and are like the most violent, and have also expanded the kind of northern Mexican style narcotics mayhem down into Guatemala and other parts of Mexico.
So is their establishment, what, like early 90s or something?
Yeah, I think the Zetas emerge actually in early, like later than that, in the early 2000s.
Oh, okay.
The major Mexican cocaine cartels start cropping up in the early 90s, I mean the late 90s. The early 90s, the Mexican drug trade is still primarily dominated by Colombians, and the Mexican role is as kind of the local auxiliaries, the fixers for the Colombians, who are trampolining cocaine through Mexico, transiting cocaine through Mexico into the U.S., and often doing, you know, due to free trade. This is how this happens. So, you know, if you're making millions and millions of dollars producing cocaine, you know, you set up an import-export company in Mexico, Colombia, and you start, you know, importing, exporting, you know, ceramics, toilet fixtures, and tiles, and you pack it with cocaine, you know, and then transship them from Mexico into the U.S. And, you know, the vast majority of the traffic coming through the free trade ports on the south of the border are not searched.
Right.
The hysteria and the repression around that border focuses on labor, not on the movement of capital. It's labor that is targeted, the movement of people. Capital, on the other hand, the contents of those trucks flows largely unimpeded and largely unexamined.
And so when they're looking for trafficked people, are they looking at different kinds of trucks? Or, I mean, is that how are they? Are they just not going into the boxes?
Yeah, your Border Patrol, like, ride-alongs, you know, they have, like, trucks, and they x-ray them and this and that. But, you know, the numbers are, it's like one out of every, you know, 250 trucks is properly examined. And some of the deals, I don't actually get into all this in the book, but, I mean, some of the arrangements with the trucking companies are ridiculous. That it's like, it's agreed that customs will examine one out of every, I think it is 250 trucks. And sometimes they even know which truck it's going to be. And so, you know, the idea that every truck, and the customs will say, we examine every vehicle that comes in. They don't physically examine them. They're aware of who's coming in. They check off the paperwork. They're in communication with the companies that own the trucks. That's what they mean by every yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to just quickly do a quick station identification here. My guest is Christian Parenti, and his book is The Tropic of Chaos, Climate Change and the New Geography of Violence, published by Nation Books. And you're listening to Write the Book on WOMMLP 105.9 FM, The Radiator in Burlington, Vermont. This interview will be made available tomorrow on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com. I was wondering if we can talk a little bit about, you offer some suggestions in the book whereby the world might be able to take a different course. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about some of your ideas.
I offer what I think, I don't offer like a complete agenda for getting out of for addressing the climate crisis. I don't have a whole, but what I do offer is what I hope to be some very realistic responses that could happen right now that also, hopefully give people heart about how this can be solved. So one thing is the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, there's a reason that the right wing in the U.S. hates that agency, and it's because it is potentially a very, very powerful agency that could play a leading role in not only protecting the environment but transforming our economy away from fossil fuels. And so that's why the Koch brothers and ExxonMobil fund groups like Americans for Prosperity, who go completely bananas in their jihad against the EPA. And the EPA has been, since 2007, required to regulate greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act. And this is one of the great tragedies of the first 2 years of the Obama administration. All that rigmarole about passing comprehensive climate legislation and these groups like Environmental Defense Fund and the National Resources Defense Council, which are really awful groups and take money from oil companies, spent over $1 billion lobbying for the passage of legislation that didn't pass, and if it would have passed, would have, among other things, stripped the EPA of its power to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, all of that was a charade, because there already is enabling legislation. It's the Clean Air Act of 1970, amended again in 1990. And there were lawsuits by environmental groups starting in the late 90s when the Senate failed to ratify the Kyoto Protocol, which Clinton signed, but the Senate failed to ratify. So they then sue to get the EPA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. They finally win. The Supreme Court says, yes, greenhouse gas emissions are harmful to human health. Therefore, the EPA has an obligation to regulate them. Well, the Bush administration ignored that ruling, and the Obama administration has sort of begun to follow the law, but not really that much. And there are about 30 rules that we're waiting for the EPA to issue as regards to the regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. The first one they did was around vehicle emissions. Previously, all those vehicle emissions, the CAFE standard, all that sort of stuff, those were state-level rules. So we've got the first federal emissions rules for vehicles. Now they're about to do something for biomass fuel. But there are other ones about coal, about gas-fired power plants, about oil refining. If those 30 rules that we're waiting on were issued and they were written in a robust and detailed and aggressive fashion, the EPA could essentially impose a de facto carbon tax, which is exactly what we want. We want to tax things, economic activities that we don't like, and we want to support and subsidize economic activities that we do like. So in other words, tax burning coal, punish burning coal, and subsidize building windmills. So this is something the EPA could do and is dragging its feet. And that doesn't require getting permission from the right wing of the Republican Party. It doesn't require getting John Boehner to believe in science or any of that. This is the law. It's about having a federal agency finally follow the law.
Right.
The other thing that could happen is that the government, the federal government plus all the state governments together, constitute about 38% of the U.S. GDP. Now, if the federal government led the way with a program of clean purchasing, what my colleague Mark Hertzgarve and I have called the Big Green Buy, it could reduce the carbon footprint of the federal government, and if state governments followed suit, that could be about one-third of the U.S. GDP. If it bought electricity from renewable sources, if it bought electric vehicles for its government fleets, if it retrofit its buildings to make them save energy and in some cases possibly even produce energy, all of that would be good in and of itself. It would have a direct impact, reduce carbon emissions from about one-third of the U.S. economy, but it would also have very positive knock-on effects in that it would create economies of scale for the burgeoning clean tech sector, which is currently suffering for lack of markets. So if the federal government said, okay, the post office is switching to electric vehicles, that would be really good for battery makers and electric vehicle makers. And it would help drive down the cost of electric vehicles and electric hybrids. So then the private sector would start adopting these technologies, or be more likely to adopt these technologies, for simple reasons of price point. When it's cheaper for a beer distributor to buy an electric truck than it is to buy a diesel truck, then they'll do it.
Yeah.
And government purchasing could play a huge role in getting us to that. And this does not require permission from the insane right wing of the GOP, who have done everything to thwart climate action. The federal government is going to buy electricity for its 450,000 large office buildings. It is going to buy tens of thousands of vehicles, and it's going to buy fuel for them. It might as well spend that money in a way that has these positive effects of helping to move us off of fossil fuels. And it's not a matter of Obama having to go and beg for money from Congress. This is money that is going to be spent. Let's use it to help jumpstart the transition to a clean economy. So that's stuff that can happen right now and is not hostage to the gridlock in D.C.
And is there any indication that it is going to happen? I know you don't want to project into the future, but I mean, well, just having talked to the people involved.
Yeah, the Obama administration did issue an executive order telling federal agencies to come up, to draw up plans to move towards clean purchasing. And there have been extensions and delays and foot dragging because, you know, the Obama administration is, you know,
busy
being a bunch of cowards and busy taking care of banks and starting new wars. So, yeah.
You researched this book for 6 years, and you must have just an enormous amount of material. And I suspect part of what would be difficult about writing a book like this, on the heels of all this research, would be deciding what material to leave out. Is that true? I mean,
yeah, definitely.
You mentioned a minute ago that there were things that you were discussing about the Border Patrol in Mexico that you didn't include in the book. So is there a lot of information like that that you didn't?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of just sort of history, you know, that just gets very far afield from the argument around climate change. So, I just tried to keep everything on, moving the argument forward. So, yeah, I mean, I in researching, I definitely had many a late night of reading interesting history, and that much of which just didn't make it into the book, I'd write 5 pages and then realize, okay, wait, that actually has to be like one paragraph.
Right. Now, how fast are these things happening? I'm wondering too, as since this book went to press, do you just see all kinds of things that you were like, oh, I would have talked about that. You know, I would have talked about this.
Yes, definitely. Well, what I mentioned earlier in the interview about the role of climate change and grain prices in triggering the Arab Spring, that happened since the book went to press. I mean, I think the last words I wrote in the book were in February, and at that point it went into the kind of slow process of editing and, you know, setting and all that sort of stuff. So that stuff all happened since the book was finalized, and this summer has seen the drought across the Southwest. That's pushing up grain prices again. All over the place, we see this.
Right. Now, are you based? I know you live in Brooklyn. Are you based in the States now for a while? Or are you going to be off doing more?
No, I am. I'm based in the States now. I got a temporary job, for a year, teaching at Brooklyn College, teaching sociology, because I have a PhD in sociology. I've always had one foot in academia and one foot in journalism. As much as I enjoyed my long run of foreign reporting, one, it's getting very hard to make a living that way, and two, I just got a little sick of the constraints of journalism. I mean, it's true, everything that academics say about journalism is true, that it is ahistorical, that it's myopic, that it's sensationalist, that it's superficial and fragmented. That's all true. And in turn, everything that journalists say about academia is also true, that it's, you know, rarefied, pseudo-intellectual. But so I'm trying to find a happy medium by combining these two traditions. And so right now I'm going to be teaching sociology, and I'll still travel a bit. Probably in the winter I might go do some work somewhere.
So, Christian, other than reading your book, are there resources you recommend people can look into if they want to better educate themselves on these subjects or maybe get involved?
You know, I guess I would say I would encourage people, in terms of educating oneself, there's plenty of information out there. I think that what's often missing is history and analysis. I would encourage people to, you know, read authors like David Harvey Mike Davis, but particularly David Harvey. He's been a huge influence on me. And in terms of getting involved, there's always local struggles that have global consequences. One of the ones I think is most important is the fight against coal. And I just came back from West Virginia, where there, you know, it's the heart of the fight against coal, against mountaintop removal. And there are local groups down there working on that, and then there are national groups that are helping them. Greenpeace and the Sierra Club, Rainforest Action Network, are also, you know, are plugging into the local fight in Appalachia. There's a direct action organization called RAMP, Radical Action for Mountain People, which is started by some Earth First veterans who've done over 100 tree sits on mountaintop removal sites and are using direct action to prevent destruction of the landscape. But that's a local fight that is important for local reasons, but is also in many ways the thin end of the wedge for the struggle to save civilization. Mm-hmm. If we're serious about climate change, the very first thing we'll do is get off coal. So it's, you know, I mean, it's really one of the most important fights going on right now. So if people are looking for some way to plug in, I really encourage them to get involved with that, or with the action against tar sands, which is going on right now, starting right now in Washington, D.C. There's going to be a pipeline. There's a proposed pipeline coming down the center of the United States to bring the Canadian tar sands to the Gulf of Mexico. President Obama has the approval over that. There's going to be direct action at the White House. People can look up tar sands action on the internet to get involved with that.
Okay.
I'm sure there are many activists in the Burlington area who are already well plugged into that.
Yeah.
I know a caravan of buses going from Vermont.
Right. Bill McKibben's a local hero. So.
Yeah.
All right. And then my last question for you, Christian, for writers who are listening, even if they don't have a lot of publication credits, how might they be able to make a difference by writing about these issues that matter to them? You've talked about how journalism is changing so much. So do you recommend starting blogs, or are there blogs that are in existence that you recommend submitting to, anything like that?
I don't really read blogs that much. I'm not a huge fan of most of what goes on blogs, just this comments and other people's comments. Well, because it's just not very, you know, it's just... It's not very sophisticated, and it's not very well informed, and it's just kind of a lot of spleen venting by and large.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's not all blogs. I don't really read blogs that much, but I did stumble upon a blog last night that I thought was excellent. It's called Peak Oil Debunked. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting. But no, I mean. For writers that want to have an impact,
yeah.
Well, I think that, you know, keeping in mind the larger questions, I mean, I think that the left has a lot to learn from the right, and the right learned a lot of its lessons from the left originally. Hayek, the father of neoliberal economics, was also a political activist of sorts, and he wrote an essay in the 1930s called Socialism and the Intellectuals. And he said that liberals, by which he meant people who wanted to see a deregulated market economy, had lost the fight against collectivism because the left had won the battle for ideas, and that the left had won the battle for ideas by keeping its eye on the core issues and the big ideas, and that the right had to do that. And the right did do that. And out of Hayek's article comes a meeting and the creation of something called the Montpellier Society. And out of the Montpellier Society comes the Koch brothers. Their father was part of that. And the whole rise of the modern think tank movement. And you'll notice that the right always, in their messaging, they always push the big ideas. It's not just about the information or the new thing. It's always about the core issues, and their core issues are that they hate the government, they venerate individual responsibility, they denigrate the idea of the collective good. And we need to return to our intellectual roots and think about what our big guiding principles are, so that whenever a writer is writing about this or that event, or commenting on this or that article, that it's guided by a deeper, broader, larger agenda that is also pushed. And, you know, so that we remind people about, you know, reconciliation with nature, the collective good, the legitimacy and centrality of government as the institution that protects people's freedom against the tyranny of the market, these kinds of core ideas. I think on the left, I think that left-wing writers are not as kind of intellectually grounded in core beliefs as the right is. So that would be my advice. I think that progressive writers do best when their specific topic of concern is also linked to the core foundational questions.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much for talking with me today. This has been fascinating.
Great. Well, thank you for having me on the show.
That, again, was a conversation with Christian Parenti. Sounds like I cut him off a little bit at the end there. I think he went on to say something else. You can learn more about his work at his website, christianparenti.com. Also, I wanted to mention that at the beginning of the show, I said that he was a visiting scholar at the City University of New York. That must be a slightly outdated part of his bio. He's now teaching sociology, as he mentioned, at Brooklyn College. This week's Write the Book prompt was inspired by my interview with Christian Parenti. Write a nonfiction article or essay, or even just a paragraph, on a subject about which you are passionate. This subject might be climate change, women's rights, the work of a nonprofit whose mission you admire, your local school budget, an examination of various diets and their effects on health, whatever matters to you. Try to include in the piece adequate historical perspective to help readers understand the background, an explanation of any confluence of events that might have relevance to your subject, and as Christian Parenti said, always be sure to keep in mind the larger issues or core ideas behind the details of your story. Don't forget to read and do your research if you hope to put this out into the world. Good luck with this exercise. Please listen next week for another. And you can find that on the podcast site. I will write it out again. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. You can also send writing prompts to that same email address. If I choose to use a writing prompt that you suggest, I will be happy to credit you for it. The Radiator is an all-volunteer organization. WOMMLP operates in Burlington thanks to community support and involvement and the hard work of a number of committed individuals. If you would like to be one of them, or if you'd like to know more about the station, check out theradiator.org. Stay tuned. I heard from Cheryl Willoughby a little while ago. She's going to be here. She's just running a couple minutes late, so I'm going to put some music on from the Vermont Music Library, and Cheryl will be in very soon. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.